This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, more and more African countries are exploring nuclear energy deals with Russia.
As a continent, 600 million people don't have electricity. As the population grows, as the economies grow, there's going to be a need for more power. And nuclear has come up as a fast way to address this deficit.
We'll be taking a closer look at the terms and conditions. And in a land not known for snow or ice, Kenya is the new kid on the ice hockey block.
I never imagined that I could play ice hockey, especially in Kenya. You'd see it maybe on Christmas movies. That's where you see snow and ice, and it's like, well, that happens somewhere else, not in Kenya. So stepping onto the ice was so slippery. I couldn't control the skates. I would just go forward, make a very huge turn. It was exciting. It was an experience, I'd say, out of this world.
How did that happen? It's Wednesday, the 15th of January. First, we go to South Africa. The world has been watching as workers emerge from a mine in South Africa after spending months trapped underground. They stayed there in a shaft 2, maybe even 3 kilometers deep near a town called Stilfontein. They are informal miners. The gold mine they were working was meant to have been decommissioned and sealed off. Images of these men being brought up from the depths of the earth are shocking. They were there for months without enough food and water. Many of them died there, and those still alive had to endure decomposing bodies alongside them. Thing is, they weren't trapped underground due to a rock fall or a mining accident. They were stuck there because the South African government and the company that owns the mine didn't mount an operation to retrieve them. People from the surrounding community did that with makeshift equipment, till a court order last week compelled the government to act. The BBC's Myeni Jones is in Stilfontein.
We weren't allowed close to the mine itself. The police kept us a few meters away, so we had to film from a distance. And you could see this crane, this big red crane, lowering this metal cage deep underground. The shaft is said to be at least 2 kilometers deep. The estimates seem to vary. Some authorities, they'd say, could be as deep as 3 kilometers deep. So hourly, this cage was being lowered down, taking supplies down to the miners and then coming back up with survivors. Initially, they were prioritizing the sickest, but they were also bringing up dead bodies. And I did ask a trade union representative what kind of prioritizing dead bodies when there were so many kind of sick and emaciated people down there. And they said it's because some of those bodies, some of these people had been dead for so long, their bodies were decomposing. And they were concerned that their families wouldn't be able to identify them if they waited much longer. So it was pretty sobering to see some of these miners being brought up. They were very emaciated, very skinny. You could see bones poking out of their shoulders and their backs. Some looked so small and so light that they looked almost like children. And the emergency services were having to help some of them walk because they could barely walk on their own. So I think it really brought home just how terrible the conditions were down there and how long these people have been going without food or water.
So people coming up, being helped, very, very emaciated. They've been there for a long time. Some of them from back in August. Just tell us a little bit about these people, Myeni. Who are they? And tell us about the community's reaction and the community's involvement in this.
So a number of these miners are said to be from the local community, from a local township. But the problem with this story, unfortunately, is that we don't know exactly how many miners are down there, right? Because it was an illegal operation. The authorities were keen to kind of point out that the vast majority of these miners are illegal migrants. And therefore, that is partly their problem with the operation. They say not only is it criminality, but it's also being carried out by people who shouldn't be in South Africa. But we did speak to a young South African woman called Zinzi Tom. Her brother, Ayanda, has been down in the mine since June. And she told us a bit more about him.
We hopefully today you will come out, because we are praying that today, because we have sent the way that he should come closer. At least the guy helped us, told us that he's in 62 level. So we are praying that he comes out, because they say that he's not in a good condition. He wanted even to go out in a gaiter's bed. So we don't know what's happening, but we have sent a way to tell him to come. He's a quiet person. He doesn't like to disclose more about his life. Yes, that's why, like, as much as I'm doing this, but I'm trying to respect his privacy at the very same time, because he's a very quiet person.
We've just been listening to Zinzi Tom, the Mayeni, a young woman whose brother is stuck in the mine. And she said something that interested me, that, you know, they had been helping people, bringing them to the surface and so on. Because we know that the South African authorities, and you hinted at that as well, had made clear that they wanted to smoke these people out rather than rescue them from, the, you know, the dire situation that they were in. So what changed between November, when we first started covering this in any detail, to now, when the South African authorities are now actually bringing people to the surface and helping them out?
Yeah, what changed is that people like Zinzi, and supported by workers' unions, supported by rights groups, took the government to court to try and compel them to start a rescue operation. There had been a dispute over, for instance, who should bear the brunt of the cost of the operation. Local media saying that it will cost up to $628,000 to extract the miners from the shaft. So there was a dispute over who should cover it. The government said that the mine was owned by a company that should cover it because they had failed to seal the mine properly and stop miners from getting there. There was also issues around the depth of the mine. It's estimated to be between 2 and 3 kilometers deep, so they needed to find the right machinery to go there. But the government also has, as you mentioned, been cracking down on illegal mining. They launched this operation last year called Vala Umgodi, which in Zulu translates as close the hole. And part of their aim was to try and close as many of these unused mines as possible, but also to take a real hard line on any illegal miners that are found down there. And that's why initially, when we were covering the story, they were refusing to bring down food and water. They had sealed some of the exits to the mine. Rights groups said they had told them that there were people trapped down there. There was one exit, but it was very awkward. The local community said they had a rope, a makeshift rope, that they were sending down the hole to try and pull people up, but it was taking up to an hour per person to bring them up. And also a lot of the miners were too weak towards the end to try and make that journey themselves. So the local community, supported by the trade unions, took the government to court, and on Friday the High Court in Pretoria found in their favour and compelled the government to start the rescue mission.
In the meantime, people have been dying, they're sick, there are dead bodies decomposing in the mines. Is there any hope that it can be speeded up? Because people are desperate and they've been there for so long.
I think what really kind of shifted the coverage of this story is video footage that was released on Monday, showing the conditions down in the mine, showing these men that were starving, showing rows and rows of bodies wrapped in plastic. And that made it very urgent that these men be pulled out. We spoke to Mzuki Sijam. He's the provincial spokesperson for the South African National Civic Organization. It's an umbrella organization that works to protect workers' rights and defend them. And he explained to us a little bit what the issues were around the rescue.
My name is Mzuki Sijam. I'm the provincial spokesperson of the South African National Civic Organization in Northwest. The rescue operation officially started yesterday. They extracted about 26 live illegal miners and 9 dead bodies. This morning, as the rescue operation is continuing, they extracted about 8 live illegal miners and 6 dead bodies. We had initially requested that we take out the dead bodies first so that we avoid a situation where they decompose to an extent that their families cannot identify them anymore, because these are the dead bodies which have been there for quite some time. But then the police also suggested that we must take dead bodies and the very sick ones. The ones that we took out, who are still alive, are the very sick ones. So we are taking out dead bodies together with the very sick ones. We were told that the rescue operation should take about 10 days. We have agreed with the company that in the process, can they allow us to take food down there? And they promised that they will allow us. We are still waiting for some food items to get here so that we can take some food items down there. We were told by our own volunteers that the number that is still underground, we've got more than 400 illegal miners who are still alive. And they also reported that we've got more than 100 dead bodies underground who are also decomposing. So we spoke to the company, considering that they said they were given 10 days to say, can they prolong their working hours? And they agreed that today they will work from 6 in the morning, perhaps until late in the evening, let's say around 10, so that we try and make sure that we get everyone out of that hole.
That's the BBC's Mayeni Jones. Now, I know this is not news to you, but Russia has been investing heavily in its relationships with African countries. Moscow continues to pursue a combination of military, diplomatic, and economic interests on the continent. In recent years, Rosatom, Russia's state-owned nuclear corporation, which holds about 70% of the global export market for new nuclear power plants, has signed agreements with various African countries to develop nuclear energy programs. According to research by the United Nations in 2023, nearly 600 million people in sub-Saharan Africa are without electricity. That's nearly half the region's population. So is Russia Africa's light at the end of the tunnel? Dr. Joseph Siegel is the director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He says it's not that simple. Just give us, in broad but vivid strokes, the situation. How many African countries already have agreements in place with Russia?
There's about 20 African countries that have memorandums of understanding to, you know, explore the development of nuclear power with Russia. Only a handful of those have signed nuclear power agreements, which is another stage of the development of the process. Ethiopia, Burundi, Zimbabwe, Mali, Burkina Faso. In practical terms, these are still discussions rather than actual implementation. The only plant that is currently under construction is one in Egypt, the El Dabab plant west of Alexandria.
Right. So we know the ones that have gone a step further than just saying that they want to do this with Russia. Give us an idea, if you would, a couple of countries dotted around the continent that are still in the initial phase.
Well, other countries that have opened the conversation include Algeria, Ghana, the Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Rwanda, Sudan, Tunisia, and Zambia. There are some other ones that have signed those memorandums of understanding.
What happened to the South Africa-Russia deal that was signed by Jacob Zuma and his government not so long ago?
Yeah, that's very instructive for the broader conversation, because there was a big deal, a $76 billion deal that had been signed. It was planned to move forward. However, you know, that was challenged within the South African court system and was ultimately blocked by high court as being unconstitutional. And then it was dismissed by the Ramaphosa government when it came into office. It was rejected because it was seen as highly one-sided in favor of the Russians. There was also a lot of concerns that it was replete with a lot of patronage and would have saddled South Africa with a huge debt that it wouldn't have been able to repay and wouldn't have been economically feasible for what the plant would have generated.
So let's take a look at the countries that are now looking to Russia to fix their power crises. Why are they turning to Russia? Because, for instance, North African countries, Algeria specifically, could turn to France. There are other West African countries, Francophone ones, that could turn to France as well. This is before relations between them soured. So why Russia now?
Well, first of all, let's be clear, these are just conversations and they haven't actually proceeded. Some of this is just dialogue. I think the bigger point is that, you know, Africa as a whole and these individual countries in particular have serious energy deficits that they're trying to fill. And they're looking at the best ways to do that. You know, as a continent in Africa, 600 million people don't have electricity, you know, 800 million people are getting their power, you know, through charcoal or kerosene. And so as the population grows, as the economies grows, there's going to be a need for more power. And the question is how best to do that. And nuclear has come up as a fast way of generating more power that can help to address this deficit. But you know, there are a whole host of other energy supply technologies out there, solar thermal, wind, geothermal, hydrogen, that is coming online that Africa could be well suited to tap into. And so I think we really want to put this conversation about, you know, Russia's outreach on the nuclear in a broader context.
Is this a Russian initiative to go out into African countries to do this? Or is it the case that other countries are not actually offering this as an option for African countries?
There are other countries that are available and have the capability to provide and help develop nuclear power in Africa. And the U.S. has been exploring possibilities with some countries. You know, China has been reaching out. France, in fact, has been working with the South Africans since the 1980s for their nuclear plant. And so there are other options. I think what we're seeing is that Russia's also using the nuclear power outreach as part of its soft power diplomacy on the continent. You know, it sees the huge energy gaps and it is marketing itself as a partner on these issues. And so it's using that as a way of, you know, advancing its geostrategic posture on the continent, even though not many of these agreements are feasible or moving forward.
Let's talk about the feasibility of these agreements and also the lessons that may or may not have been learned from the South African experience. These new deals or these new attempts, do we know some of the elements of them and are they on better terms than the South African one was?
Again, there aren't any other deals that are that as far advanced to compare with, but that is the big concern. You know, we do have another active project underway in Egypt. And this is a $30 billion deal with the Egyptians to build 4 reactors. That too is controversial because of the cost and whether it's something the Egyptians are going to be able to repay. 80% of that, about $25 billion, was financed by the Russians. And so it creates an indebtedness that Egyptian citizens are going to have to repay over time. And so there are big questions economically on whether that's going to be viable. It also raises an important political question because with that level of indebtedness, it opens a country up to leverage from an external actor. And when we talk about nuclear power, it's really important to consider this is a decades-long investment. You know, the technology, the technical expertise that is required really has to come from countries that already have nuclear power. And so it's really wedding a country to this external partner for some time where they're going to be dependent on that particular expertise. And so you really need to choose your partner wisely because this could be a real long-term and costly commitment.
If we take a look at the deals that are sort of advanced and what they broadly entail, let's say Egypt, who do you think benefits most from the deals?
Well, obviously, there's going to be different opinions on this, depending on who you talk to. But one does have concerns when you look at the huge cost and the huge debt leverage that Egypt has taken on with that deal. And as with South Africa, there's a worry that there is going to be a lot of payouts to connected individuals on both sides and questions about whether the plant will be completed, how much it will generate, and how much it's ultimately going to benefit the citizens of Egypt.
You said that there's a handful of countries that have gone to the MOU stage of an agreement. Do you see any of them coming off to the extent that we have seen in Egypt?
It's hard to speculate. And again, this speaks as much to the politics as the economics. And so, for example, there's been some renewed activity, discussion between Zimbabwe and Russia about developing their nuclear power capacity. And, you know, Zimbabwe, of course, has become increasingly close partner to Russia as it has become isolated politically, more generally, internationally. And so on the one hand, some of this is posturing on the part of both Russia and Zimbabwe to elevate their partnership. But, you know, in the end, it will come down to the economics of this. And, you know, some of the same concerns about, does Zimbabwe take on a huge amount of debt for a nuclear power deal that may not generate the energy that it could get through other sources more cheaply, I think will come back into play.
How serious is this? Is Russia serious in pursuing this? Are the countries that have signed it serious in doing this?
For the last several years, many people didn't think it was that serious, but it's taken more seriously on the continent and internationally, you know, as Russia has aggressively tried to market itself as a nuclear energy provider, as Africa grapples with these huge energy needs, and with a number of governments who are not necessarily accountable to their citizens. So they're more likely to sign a deal and taking on this debt without the proper oversight and accountability that would otherwise be the case.
Dr. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center of Strategic Studies. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now listen to this and tell me which game is being played. It's ice hockey. Did you guess that right? I didn't. Anyway, Kenya's Ice Lions are practicing ice hockey with their Canadian coach, Tim Colby. I know you are wondering why people in a country not known for ice or snow are playing a game that is associated with countries where ice and snow is the order of the day. It's difficult to see how it could become a major sport on the continent, but interest is growing in several countries, with national teams being formed in Kenya, South Africa, Morocco, Algeria, and Egypt. The Kenyan team recently became members of the International Ice Hockey Federation, and now they want to compete on the international stage. Brian Kisa is a journalist in Nairobi. He's been watching the Ice Lions practice, and he's been finding out how ice hockey came to Kenya.
Ice hockey is not that popular in Kenya. Speaking from personal experience, the only reason I even knew the sport existed was from like TV shows, like from Disney's Mighty Ducks, which is a show about like an ice hockey team in Canada. So that's the only like way my interaction I had with the sport. And for other Kenyans, like they just see it on TV. But there was the time when the ice rink was opened up at Panari in Nairobi, and a few expats started just kind of renting the space to play ice hockey. And then more and more people, especially like local Kenyans, started picking up the interest. And that's how the Ice Lions were formed, just from, you know, local enthusiasts curious about the sport, taking the chance and taking the opportunity to play this interesting sport.
So what inspired these enthusiasts to actually start playing hockey and to take it so seriously as well?
Well, I think one being most of them already had some sort of experience playing hockey, just like infield hockey. And most of them usually gather and play on weekends in Nairobi CBD using like rollerblades. And when the ice rink opened up and these expat teams started showing up with the gear and with all these things that these people have seen on TV playing on the ice, it kind of spawned an interest amongst these young people to, you know, make that transition, move from just like regular inland hockey and play ice hockey and experience ice hockey. Because for most of them, you know, it obviously doesn't snow in Kenya. So being able to experience that skiing on ice is definitely something that drew these young men. We got a chance to speak with the Kenya Ice Lions captain, Benjamin Buru, and let's hear what he has to say about the sport.
I never imagined that I could play ice hockey, especially in Kenya. You'd see it maybe on Christmas movies. That's where you see snow and ice, and it's like, well, that happens somewhere else, not in Kenya. So stepping onto the ice was so slippery. Luckily, I had the balance from the inline hockey, but then I couldn't control the skates. I would just go forward, make a very huge turn. It was exciting. It was an experience, I'd say, out of this world.
That was Benjamin Mburu, who's the captain of the team. So they had the ice rink built, they had the equipment, but I'm just wondering, was it actually difficult for them to get used to playing on ice?
Well, from the discussions we had with them, since they already had the experience with inland hockey and rollerblading on land, in principle, it's more or less the same. However, when it comes now to the traction, it's very different because traction on land versus traction on ice is actually very different. So it's a bit more slippery. Even when I went on the ice, I struggled a lot to gain my balance and, you know, stay upright. But for Benjamin and the team, since they already had that experience with rollerblading and inland hockey, the transition wasn't as difficult.
Ice hockey involves a lot of safety equipment, and we've been hearing that the players didn't necessarily have the right equipment, because I imagine that it would have been expensive to get, you know, to import into Kenya, you know, and people enthusiastic, but not necessarily knowing what the right equipment was either. So how did they deal with that?
You're absolutely right. Ice hockey is a very physical sport and it needs very specialized equipment. And Benjamin Mburu actually shared the experience of how they were able to acquire the equipment.
For the longest, most of us played with just shin pads, which was the bare minimum. The other issue was hockey sticks. If a hockey stick broke, you'd have to wait another, like, say, 3-4 months before maybe an expert would bring you one or someone leaves one behind.
Benjamin Mburu again. Is it a men-only sport, or are women also getting involved?
Women are actually getting involved. The Kenya Ice Lions are in the process of starting a women's team. We actually got a chance to speak with a Kenya Ice Lions player, Caroline Joseph, who shared her story as to how she joined the team.
Playing ice hockey feels amazing together with the men, because we are also growing as women, because we also want to grow as a women's team.
That's Caroline Joseph. What about the future of the game? I'm sure people are hoping that it will grow and grow rather than sort of be a flash in the pan.
So the future looks very bright for ice hockey in Kenya, because it's not just like professionals and grown-up enthusiasts who are taking part and participating in this sport. We actually got to see so many young kids from across the city who just came over the weekends to practice. Kids from as young as 5. You can imagine these small kids bundled up in all that gear. It was quite an interesting sight. And yet they skied like experts, way better than me. We actually got a chance to speak with one of them. His name is Liam Tashani.
I love ice hockey very much because the coaches push you to be your best. You're playing on the ice, like, it just feels, you forget about everything else.
Liam Pashani, a young person, taking it up there. What does ice hockey mean for these players, do you think, Brian?
I think for most of them, it means that they have an opportunity to create, basically to forge a new future for themselves, to take them out of where they are, because some of them come from, you know, not well-to-do families, but this sport is offering them an opportunity to, you know, even grow economically. It's taking them out of this country. It's flying them out of this country. They get a chance to go to Canada and South Africa and all these other countries and participate on the global stage and represent their country in the process.
That's the journalist Brian Kisa in Nairobi. Focus on Africa was put together by Victor Silver, Nyasha Michelle, Priya Sipi, and Sunita Nahar here in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer. Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Bedengi are our editors. Our pod sister, Africa Daily, will be looking at the situation in Mozambique as unrest continues following the disputed election of Daniel Chapo. Mpola Gaje will be talking to the Mozambican journalist Fernando Gonzalez about the priorities for the new government. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.